going to call this committee to order. This is the Monday, March 4th, 2013 meeting of the Transportation and Public Safety Committee meeting. Was that department of redundancy department? And we have members 5 bills on the agenda. And we will start with the 2 bills from Senator Kent. And I'm going to hand the gavel over to Senator Carlson. Quorum is present.
Mr. Chair, just for sake of knowing what we're doing, are we voting on these, or are these just being held over for omnibus? Just out of curiosity.
I'm told we're voting on these, which does not preclude. So we'll move all of these to the floor. Thank you for asking, Senator Osmick. Does not preclude that they might show up at a future in a future omnibus bill. You know, it's called the old dual track.
Thank you. My name is Jim Carlson, and I'm sitting in for first for Senator Kent and then for Senator Dibble. And first bill today is Senate File 772, Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members. Today I am here with a couple of...
We're not getting you on the mic.
I'm here today with a couple of MnDOT bills, agency bills. The first one is up is Miscellaneous Transportation Policy and Provisions Modifications, affectionately known as the Housekeeping Bill. And it is a wide range of specific fixes, adjustments, updates to reflect some things that are going on. And at that, I will turn this over to Eric Rudine from the Department of Transportation.
Senator Kent, this is Senate File 772.
Yes, sorry, 772. Okay. Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Rudine, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Eric Rudine with MnDOT Government Affairs. I'll briefly walk through the bill. Sections 1, 2, and 3 of the bill amend the logo sign program. These are the large blue signs that you see along freeways in the state. They identify travel information such as gas, food, lodging, and camping. And so the main change in that section would allow attractions to also be listed on the logo signs. Attractions are allowed to charge entrance fees. We are making some other minor technical changes, such as referring to gas or alternative fuels instead of just fuel, so that matches the federal definition. There are some technical changes about the minimum hours of operation. Currently, businesses must be open 7 days per week, and we're changing it so that a business that's closed one day per week will be allowed to be eligible for the signs. Gas stations will have to be located within 3 miles of an interchange in an urban area. And then the last change in the logo sign program is that substantially eligible businesses will be allowed to have a sign if there is space available. So currently a business has to be fully eligible before they're allowed to have space. But again, under this change, if there's a substantially eligible business, they will be allowed, if they so choose, to have a sign. So those are the changes in Sections 1, 2, and 3 of the bill. Section 4 modifies the emergency relief account. It allows the account to be used for maintenance activities that are conducted by MnDOT. Currently, the law only allows contracted work to be used through this account. Another change there eliminates the return of interest to the account. The interest will still be accrued. However, the interest will be credited to the larger trunk highway fund rather than to this individual account, which should save some bookkeeping hassle for our employees. This account was established in 2010 with a $5 million appropriation, and it's intended to provide funding for work that is necessary to keep a highway open for travel during or following an emergency. Sections 5 and 6 relate to when MnDOT receives a variance request from state aid standards. Currently, the law requires us to publish that request in the state register. However, the variance requests are submitted in the form of a city board or a city council resolution or county board resolution. And because it's already gone through that public process, we feel it's somewhat duplicative to then publish the request in the state register. And we have never actually received any comments through that process. Because, again, there's a public process already that city or county must undertake before the request gets to us. Typically, we receive approximately 12 to 15 of these requests per year. Section 7 of the bill deletes an obsolete reference to something that was referred to as a combination route. That was a route that carried a county state aid highway designation and a municipal state aid street designation over the same section of roadway. We've actually not had these routes in existence for several years, and the other references were deleted from the statutes several years ago, and so this is just kind of cleaning up a section of statute where that reference still exists. Section 8 of the bill repeals or makes a modification to the method of payments for Greater Minnesota Transit Service Providers. Currently, if you look at Section 14 of the bill, which we're repealing, the schedule for payments is spelled out in statute for payments from the general fund and from the Greater Minnesota Transit account, which is the account that receives motor vehicle sales tax revenues. And this language has been somewhat problematic as we've administered the Greater Minnesota Transit Program. One of the problems we've had is that the schedule that's in the statute directs us to disperse motor vehicle sales tax revenues before the department actually receives them. And so we've had to cash flow that account. And rather than have the payment schedule spelled out in statute, we're proposing that we would reach an agreement with every transit service provider, and the payment schedule would appear in the contract with the transit service providers. Sections 9, 10, and 11 of the bill allow yield signs at railroad crossings. These are passive crossings that do not have gates and flashing lights. And currently, the state law allows stop signs at those crossings. However, the federal law currently allows yield signs where appropriate. So we're proposing to also allow yield signs under the state statute. Each individual crossing would continue to be evaluated on a case-by-case basis to determine whether a stop sign or a yield sign is more appropriate. But there are certain locations where a stop sign may not be appropriate and a yield sign would be more appropriate. We're also making some technical corrections there to language that's in the statute about the types of signs that appear at railroad crossings and the distance that they need to be located from the railroad tracks. Sections 12 and 13 of the bill relate to medical examiners and medical waivers. Currently, a medical certificate can be provided for somebody who drives a commercial vehicle can be provided by any medical examiner. However, the federal government is establishing a national registry of certified medical examiners, and that program will require all medical examiners to be certified and trained, and they will be required to perform medical exams for people who drive across state lines. And so to remain consistent with interstate requirements, we're proposing that for drivers who drive intrastate or within the borders of the state, we would also follow that same program. And then Section 13 of the bill relates to a medical waiver program for certain people who drive intrastate. There is currently under state law a three-year waiting period for somebody who has their license suspended or revoked before they can be eligible for a medical waiver. And a medical waiver would be for example, if you have diabetes, but you can prove through a medical exam that that condition is under control and you can safely operate a commercial vehicle, you can receive a medical waiver. And the three-year wait that's in the state statute is inconsistent with federal regulations, and so the Office of Administrative Hearings has pointed this out and ruled that because we're inconsistent, we should instead be following the federal program, so that's what the changes that we're proposing in Section 13 would accomplish. The repealers in Section 14, as I mentioned, the current payment schedule for Greater Minnesota Transit Operating Assistance would be repealed, and that is replaced in an earlier section with some other language. And then the second repealer there repeals something in state rules, and again, this is related to the requirement to publish the notice of a state aid variance request in the state register. Mr. Chair and Committee, that's a very quick summary of the bill. Be happy to try to answer any questions. We also have some folks in the audience here to help with that if necessary.
Is there anyone in the audience that would like to comment on this bill? Any testifiers? Does the committee have questions? Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Kent, just a quick question. When we take out, I'm thinking page two, when we take out the counties in the Southern County metro area and replace it with urban.
Sorry, I need my microphone. Thanks.
Page two, where?
Page two, where you strike the seven county metro area and replace it with urban. I'm presuming that's for Duluth, St. Cloud, some of the other predominantly regional centers. But I'm wondering, where do we actually define urban versus rural?
Senator Kent.
I'm going to defer to Mr. Rudin on this one.
Mr. Rudin.
Mr. Chair and Senator Pratt, it would be an urbanized area, so an area that is developed and incorporated. You can have certainly, as you mentioned, you can have urban areas outside the seven counties, but you can also have non-urbanized areas within the seven counties. And so the change there is the distance that a business needs to be located from the interchange, and rather than have one standard for the seven county metro and a separate for outside the seven county, we would have the standard be for an urbanized area versus a non-urbanized area.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Kent, Mr. Rudin, I don't disagree with the intent. I'm just being new at this, I guess. I'm looking for how can things get misconstrued, who's going to decide what's urban versus rural. I'd rather see it defined than left open for interpretation.
Mr. Rudin.
Mr. Chair and Senator Pratt, I'm fairly certain there is a federal definition of what standard we would be using. I'd be happy to get that to you. I guess it wasn't our feeling that it needed to be in the statute because there is, again, as I said, a federal definition that we would be using. But I'll provide that to the committee, and if there are concerns, we can certainly talk about that some more.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dean. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On Section 8, on page 5, talks about the method of payment, and so the payments will include now operating assistance, and on line 25 it says excluding operating assistance. So before it was specifically excluded and now it is included. I just want to be sure, because they're kind of flipping it over there. Is that correct? So now you're including operating assistance?
Mr. Rudin.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, yes, that's correct. And the reason we're making that change is because there, currently under the law, there is a separate section of statute that describes the schedule for operating assistance. So although currently 5A, subdivision 5A, excludes operating assistance, there is a separate subdivision which does include operating assistance. So rather than having the two separate subdivisions, we're sort of combining them into one.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's all I have.
So, Mr. Radin, now you're saying that in another location it did include operating assistance, and so you're removing the conflict? Is that what you're doing?
Mr. Chair, there was a separate schedule spelled out in statute that we're actually repealing under this bill.
Ms. Berezovsky, maybe you could explain that to the audience.
Mr. Chair and Senators, the current statute in 174 has several subdivisions in 174.24 that relate to assistance to greater Minnesota transit providers. Subdivision 5 is being repealed in this bill, and in that subdivision, it sets forth a schedule of payments for operating assistance. Since that is being repealed, the references to operating assistance have now been rolled into the subdivision 5A. So it becomes simply assistance rather than distinguishing between operating and non-operating.
Thank you. Any questions on that? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Following up on that, so what I heard you say before in this repealer is that all of this was a cash flow issue for you, that you're repealing on subdivision five there? And that by removing that or just putting in operating assistance, it saves, this looks like a lot of paperwork, a lot of calculation, plus the cash flow.
Mr. Radin.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, yes, you're correct. I think it has been difficult to administer under the current schedule that's in statute, so it's our hope that by making this change, it will be easier to administer. And the cash flow issue was not related so much to the general funds, but to the payments from the Greater Minnesota Transit account, which is the account that receives the motor vehicle sales tax money that goes to Greater Minnesota Transit. And the schedule that's in statute currently directs us to disperse those monies before we actually receive them. And so that was where the cash flow issue problem was coming in.
Mr. Chairman, one follow-up
Senator
to that.
Kiffmeyer.
Does this change the amount of money that any entity gets or affect how much money they get?
Mr. Radin.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, no, it will not have any impact on that. It will only affect the timing of the payments.
Okay.
Any other questions from the committee? Senator Sinjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the witness, or perhaps even to Senate Counsel. On page 3, line 14, and you reference this in your testimony, a substantially eligible business. Is that defined somewhere? What a substantially eligible business might be?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sinjum, yes, again, I believe there's a federal definition, which I'd be happy to get for you. But, for example, it might be if a business does not meet the required minimum hours of operation, but they come close to meeting the minimum hours of operation, then under this language they would become eligible for a sign if space is available.
Mr. Chair, could you give any examples at all of what a substantially eligible business might
be? Mr. Chair and Senator Sinjum,
just even type of business.
For example, if you had an establishment that serves food, they're under the law, they're required to be open a certain number of hours and provide seating capacity for at least 20 people. So if you had a very small establishment that had seating capacity for, say, 18 people, they're not completely eligible under the law, but okay, they would be substantially eligible. So if there's space available, they would be eligible for a sign.
So, Mr. Chair, so a restaurant that may be otherwise eligible but maybe isn't because of some criteria or lodging location or whatever it is. So if they're of that type but not quite meeting all of the criteria, they may be substantially eligible. Is that it? And the question really is, it doesn't pull in something other than is already there in terms of types of business?
Mr. Reed.
I.e. gas, restaurants, attractions.
Mr. Chair and Sir Sendrum, that's correct.
Okay.
Yes, it's not intended to broaden the types of businesses that are eligible.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee?
Senator Carlson, I got to ask.
Senator Tomasoni.
Well, I think I understand what this means. Food services must serve at least two meals a day, like noon and evening, I think it refers to. Is that what you're thinking? But two meals per day, could that mean you had two clients and they served two meals to them?
Mr.
Medina. What restaurants aren't open long enough to serve two meals per day?
Mr. Chair and Senator Tomasoni, you're correct. It envisions like lunch and dinner or breakfast and lunch. It doesn't refer to the number of meals or customers that they're serving. It's.
But are there any restaurants that don't serve two meals a day?
Mr. Chair and Senator Tomasoni, there may be some restaurants that are only open for dinner, I would suspect. I'm not positive.
Senator Tomasoni, a supper club.
How long are they
supper
in business
club
for?
Might be just one meal.
But I got a funny feeling if you walked in there at 3, they'd serve you. I mean, this seems like a funny definition to me. But anyway, and back to Senator Sendrum,
Senator Tomasoni.
Substantially, why don't you just say meets the letter of the law? Why would we have to actually have somebody make a calculation as to what substantially is?
Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Tomasoni, I think part of what we're doing here is trying to provide a service to travelers on the road and give them information about services that are available. And assuming that we've maxed out all the ones that are completely available, and there's just, say, one of them, and there's another restaurant down the street that has slightly shorter hours, it might be worth it to them to have that information. We would not be displacing any businesses that completely meet. It would just say, here's another, you know, you're on a stretch of road that there's not much there. Here's another option.
Mr. Chair, do the businesses pay for that posting? Is that part of it, or?
Mr. Chair and Senator Tomasoni, yes. On these signs, these are the signs with the actual business logos. Yes, the businesses pay for that service, and it's completely optional. It's a business decision for each individual business whether or not they want to choose to participate in the program.
But they have to be eligible.
Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chair and Senator Tomasoni, that's correct.
Okay.
Senator Tomasoni, eligible or substantially eligible?
Or substantially eligible, and then they have to pay on top of it, so they're advertising. You think you'd let anybody who wants to pay for it be on there?
Any other questions from the committee? Senator Sengen.
I've been attracted by Senator Tomasoni. Look at line 216 again. And as I read it, it says serving at least two meals a day, 6 days a week. And so, kind of, if you have two customers, if you have two or three customers, you've met the criteria, right?
Mr. Reddin, Senator Kent.
I would just say they're probably out of business.
And Mr. Chair, my point is that good legislative language? I mean, because I think some people could interpret it as that. And I would maybe defer to counsel, but serving at least two meals, Senator Tomasoni and I go into this restaurant 6 days a week. Why, they may be out of business, but if they're not, we're still eligible, right?
Based on how we eat, they'd be okay.
Mr. Chair
Mr.
and Senators, I I can see your point there, and we can maybe work on some clearer language. The intent was to get away from minimum hours per day that the business needed to be opened. Under current law, they have to be open at least 10 hours per day, which not all businesses meet, and so we were looking to get away from that requirement.
Mr. Chair, and I would just offer, it seems like we're trying to be somewhat really, really prescriptive here. I'm not sure it's necessary. They're either open or they're not, based on economics and product.
Senator St. John, what's your pleasure?
I haven't, Mr. Chair, I have not attempted. I just think I'm reading something that looks a little strange. I don't have a pleasure necessarily at this point. I'm not in the study mode in terms of trying to fix it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry if I missed the opening testimony. So what's the reason for limiting it, the blue signs, to certain businesses?
Mr. Redeem.
Mr. Chair and Senators, the program is a national program, and so there are federal standards that businesses must meet so that a traveler who's traveling, you know, from here to Texas, for example, knows that a certain type of business will be approximately the same in each location. So the requirements that we have here in state law are mirroring what's required under the federal program. So I think regardless of how specific we are in the state statute, we still have to follow the requirements of the federal program, which have minimum hours of operation and distance from...
I don't mind that, but Mr. Chairman, we're trying to expand it, though, here, aren't we?
Mr. Chair and Senator Thompson, that's correct. And I was just saying to Senator Kent that if the language on 2.16 is causing concern for people, I think it would be fine with the department if we strike that new language.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Zinjum.
As I read this second time, I kind of wonder, seasonal food business must provide a continuous staff food service operation. And then I just wonder if we just couldn't go to line 17 during their months of operation. It seems like if it's continuous and it's staffed, it's fairly complete in its service hours and its offerings, without trying to get into a menu of specificity there that somebody's going to have to kind of look at it in a more intricate way and try to figure out whether or not they meet it. To me, if they're continuous and they're staffed, they're probably at least in business.
Well, it gets better, Mr. Chairman. Provide public access to a telephone. Who has those now?
Senator Tomasoni,
I said provide public access to a telephone. Who has public telephones now? Are we taking those all out?
Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that just means that somebody coming in from the public whose phone has died could have access to a telephone in case of a need or an emergency. Doesn't have to be the old Ma Bell box on the wall.
Why would we even have those things in there? A restroom and a public access to a telephone. I think Senator Zinjum has got something on his suggestion.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kent.
Thank you. Senators, I would just go back to the notion, and this goes back to what Mr. Redeen was saying about this being a federal program. This is in addition to there being an advertising element to it, fundamentally it's providing information to people on the highways and saying, if you stop here, you will find the services you're looking for. And if it's businesses that are not regularly open, easy to get to, do not provide a certain minimum level of service, then it's sort of defeating the purpose. And so there is a traveler, roadside traveler aspect to this that is embedded in this, although we can certainly look at some of the specific pieces of language.
Senator Kent, I guess what I'm thinking is that this is not intended to be a yellow pages. This is intended to be information for drivers, a short list, I'm assuming. But I guess, thinking about this public telephone, I don't know how the future is of public telephones, whether we're actually going to have any more public telephones in the very near future. I'm not sure adding that to this list, unless it's federally, is there some federal requirement for a telephone?
Mr. Chair, if it's okay, we can have somebody who is more familiar with the program come up and try to answer that question for us.
Thank you. Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And while we wait, I will just refer back to it says provide public access to a telephone, not a public telephone.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Kent. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Peter Buchan. I'm the Assistant State Traffic Engineer. With regards to this language, it does, as Eric had indicated, it's to be consistent with the federal guidelines. Our current policy is defined both in statute and through the Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Devices, which is set up by the Federal Highway Administrations. We create a manual that mirrors that with exceptions that are included in statute. And then the Federal Highway Administration accepts that as being substantially compliant with their manual and the requirements in that manual. With regards to the public telephone, that as Senator Kent indicated, the intent of this is so that motorists traveling along the road will see services that they need, such as gas, food, and lodging. And when they stop, they will expect a certain level of service to be available to them so that we do not direct them off of the road to a destination that is either closed or doesn't meet their needs. So that is the intent.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Senator Kent, would you like to move the bill as is? I see we've lost a couple of our members here who weren't comfortable with some of the words, but would you like to move the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank
you. Would you do that, please?
I would like to move that we pass this bill to the floor.
Senator Kent moves Senate File 772 to be recommended to pass and proceed to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, we'll move to Senate File 802. Senator Kent. Okay. Senator Kent, your next
bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. Now I would like to introduce Senate File 802, which is a trunk highway system legislative routes modification. It transfers certain routes from the jurisdiction of the trunk highways back to a city or county. Within this, there is also a new route number for the St. Croix River crossing. In this case, all the jurisdictions have already agreed to this, so this is relatively non-controversial, I suppose. So with that, I will let Mr. Rudin take us through the specifics. Thank you.
Mr. Rudin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For those of you who are new to the legislature or new to the committee, I'll just provide a little bit of background about trunk highway turnbacks. The purpose of turnbacks is to improve trunk highways that no longer serve a trunk highway purpose and allow them to be turned back to a city or county in an acceptable condition. Some of these turnbacks are initiated at the request of MnDOT, and others are initiated at the request of the local road authority. Turnback funds may be used for a construction project to improve the route being turned back, or they may be made in the form of a lump sum payment to the city or county to pay for future maintenance and repair. This program works toward ensuring that the right road is on the right system, and it generally relies on situational opportunities to create agreements with local governments that are consistent with that long-term goal. Section 1 of this bill allows MnDOT to transfer a portion of Highway 298 in Faribault to the Department of Corrections as a private road. This portion of Highway 298 really functions as an access road for a Department of Corrections facility, and would be better managed by that agency. The change was requested by Department of Corrections and is supported by the State Academy for the Blind, which also has a facility on this section of roadway. Section 2 of the bill adds a new legislative route number, route number 339, and this is a result of the relocation of Trunk Highway 36 to the new roadway and bridge that will be constructed as part of the St. Croix River Crossing Project. So this change will not really be seen by the general public. It will be still referred to as Highway 36, but this officially brings that new section of highway onto the Trunk Highway system. Section 3 of the bill will turn back jurisdiction of Highway 235 between Parker's Prairie and Urbank over to Ottertail County, and the county does support this turn back. And then Section 4 of the bill turns jurisdiction of Route 256, which is actually signed as Highway 66, over to Blue Earth County. The county supports the turn back, and in turn, they are working with the city of Mankato. They will be turning a portion of the roadway over to the city for that part that is within the city limits. We do have maps of these projects that have been distributed. Hopefully those maps make it fairly clear the sections that are being turned back over, and also show the new portion for Legislative Route 339. Mr. Chair, the turnback bills are something we have typically every year. They're just kind of a way to clean up the statutes, because the statute does list all sections of Trunk Highway, and so it's necessary periodically to come and make changes to the descriptions of the routes, or to add or delete or modify the routes as necessary.
Any questions from the committee? Senator Sender.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe just a procedural question, somewhat related to the bill, but not specifically. In my community, there's been a lot of discussion about turning back Highway 63 to the city of Rochester, and you know, headlines in the paper and all that. I was under this understanding that was done or not. But the question is, do all turnbacks go through a legislative process, or can some of them be handled administratively?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Redeem,
and Senator Senjum, some of them can be handled administratively, and okay. I believe that's the case with the Rochester turnback, because the new route will still go through the city of Rochester, and so it's not necessary to change the description that's in the statute.
Okay.
We're only required to come to the legislature if we're repealing a route entirely or changing the route by such a degree that it changes the names of the cities. Excuse me, the names of the cities that are connected by the route.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions from the committee? Senator Kent, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would like to move Senate File 802 for passage and to proceed to the floor.
Senator Kent moves Senate File 802 to be recommended to pass and proceed to the Senate floor. All those in favor say aye.
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 All opposed, same sign. Motion is approved. Thank you, Senator. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Chair. Chair passed.
Mr. Chair.
Senate File 590, Senator Carlson.
Senate File 590 is a bill about
bit of a change to access to the Skyway in downtown St. Paul in an area where there hasn't been a plan for that access, but it is this particular station is right dead center in St. Paul, and it seems like there needs to be some accommodation. If you have all your background there, you'll see that there is no fiscal note. There's money available to do this. What it is to provide an access to the Skyway from the station, the light rail station. And with me, I have Mr. Rick Cardenas to describe what he's asking for and what we should be doing there. This particular station stop is not required by the ADA, the National ADA law, but it is something that, if you'd look at all the details that surround it, it meets the spirit of ADA. So I, with that, I'd like to ask Mr. Venus to describe the situation to you.
Thank you, Senator Carlson. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Cardenas.
Thank you, Chair Dibble and members of the committee. I think in front of you have a map which shows where the station is, and been working on this for a number of years, and I was able to was able to get some funds from the Corridors of Opportunity grant a while ago, and we're able to push this a little bit more. If you look at the map, the kitty corner turn that the RT takes is where the station is. Previously, Bremer Building was sitting there, which had a bank of three elevators. But if you notice the little yellow E's, those are the closest elevators to that station. There is a emergency stairs that goes down alongside the St. Paul Athletic Club, whatever its name is now. That doesn't have a wheelchair access, but it has an emergency exit. So persons in wheelchairs are not going to get down. That may be an ADA issue that we could address. I live downtown, not to be selfish about this, but there are numerous buildings that are going on downtown that will have new residents. And I think that each of those buildings that you see, the First National Bank building, the Pioneer Press, the St. Paul Athletic Club, Alliance Bank, U.S. Bank, those immediately surrounding that one block have approximately 5,000 to 6,000 people using that for in and out every day. Doesn't count the residents, which are a little bit farther away. The issue, I think, for accessibility is that there's a fresh snow like we're going to have tonight. If you were trying to access the LRT and you lived in the Skyway, you wouldn't be able to get down because there's no elevator. And you certainly wouldn't be able to traverse the snow, the fresh snow that's going to be there. The building, the parking ramp near the Minnesota building, does have an elevator. However, there are numerous inaccessible doors to get to the ground or the elevator. So that's not a solution either. In the evening, the buildings are generally closed at 5:30, and you can't even get into the Skyway unless you go to the hotel, Crown Plaza, up the road, and you can get into one of the buildings if you have a pass card. So if you're a tenant within the building, then you can get in there. So over 5,000 people generally will be taking they are employed around there. Many of them will be taking the LRT, we hope. And so that's generally what I have here.
Thank you, Mr. Cardenas. Questions, members? All right. I know that my council is here, and I think they wanted to have an opportunity to speak as well. Senator Carlson?
I just wanted to add a little bit of what Rick said, that there's a, approximately, if you use a rule of thumb, about 6,000 people that work nearby in office space that occupies about 1.5 million square feet. So this is really a central jumping off point for the central corridor, and it is something that will be heavily used.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senators. Mark Furman, Deputy General Manager with Metro Transit. I'm responsible for the Central Corridor and Southwest LRT projects. Mr. Chair, as the Senator and Mr. Cardenas said, this item and issue has a couple-year history, and in the past, Metropolitan Council and our Government Relations Director, Judd Shetnan, had testified in opposition. Today we come before the committee with new information and we believe positive information. There have been technical issues that we have been working through over the last couple of years, property issues with City of St. Paul, funding for the actual construction of the elevator and stair tower, and then operations and maintenance responsibilities long term. So in working through those three issues, we are negotiating the final agreement with the St. Paul Housing and Redevelopment Authority to swap some property to allow for this to happen. We have identified two sources of capital funding that would fund this project. It's estimated about $1.4 million in total. Some of that money is from the Central Corridor Light Rail Transit Project, which means about slightly less than 10% is from state funds. Those are existing funds, not new funds, within the project. So this this bill has no fiscal impact for state capital. And then the third component is the ongoing operation and maintenance responsibilities. We at Met Council are not responsible for maintaining skyways and elevators in downtown. So we're, again, working with City of St. Paul to seek their commitment to fund the ongoing heating maintenance of this new elevator tower. So, Mr. Chair, we're working closely with the city and certainly trying to further promote the vitality and accessibility of our central station downtown and to all of the vitality of downtown St. Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Furman. Questions, members? Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Furman, Senator Carlson, I guess I'm struggling with why this becomes a state issue when we've got City of St. Paul, we've got Metro Transit, we've got a number of entities already collaborating, working on this. It seems it's us usurping their authority and mandating upon them how they should be managing their business. I'm not saying it's not a good idea. It seems to make a lot of sense, but why in state law?
Senator Carlson.
Senator Pratt, Mr. Chair and Senator Pratt, probably the reason that it is that it has taken 3 years, and we're very happy to hear the information here. So, I guess what we'd have to do is we have to look at whether this needs to have a bill behind it. If we're talking that now it's going to happen, that perhaps the necessity of a bill might go away.
Mr. Cardenas.
Mr. Chair, and one of the reasons that the bill was brought forward was because there has been verbal, kind of semi-verbal official commitment that this would happen. However, it has never been in writing, and it's never been testified to any legislative committee. So I'm extremely happy that that is coming, that there are funds available to accomplish that accessibility task. So, and I think that the Met Council is an arm of the state, so I think that's another reason that it would be necessary to come through the state to ask that the Met Council take care of this issue. The city is something different, but indeed they are willing to participate in this, it sounds like, so I'm happy about that. If we don't need legislation, that's fine, but when I see it in writing and when I see the green stuff, then we'll be happy.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Point of clarification, and I'm not sure who best to answer this. As we, you know, as the legislature approves these projects, at what point in time do issues like this get raised up and addressed at when we approve a project and allocate the funding versus having to address it on the back end? And I'm not sure where that's best addressed, but being new to the legislature, but it seems like this is certainly something that the legislature would have intended and would have been able to put in the requirements at the point in time the project was approved. Or do oversights happen?
Anyone want to take a stab at that? So, Senator Pratt, we kind of get our ideas when we get our ideas. and sometimes stuff comes to our attention, from the community. Early, midstream, late. This one has been around for a while. I agree completely with Senator Carlson and Mr. Cardenas and, frankly, the Met Council. This probably shouldn't be the subject of legislation. This is micromanagement. It's attending to a detail that I'd be reluctant to do. However, saying that, I've been chief author of this bill in the past myself because... it's a problem that Mr. Cardenas pointed out to us a while ago. And if you've not been down to this area, I'd encourage you to go take a look. I mean, this is it's a funny little, you see how it kind of goes diagonally through the block. So it's a kind of a unique station where you're kind of out in the middle of nowhere. Fine for us, able, quick-footed folks, but folks who have mobility impairments, they're kind of stranded out in the middle of nowhere, and on when the snow starts flying, really difficult to kind of get up into the skyways to get around downtown. So, there's no good answer to your question, I guess. But sometimes we move a bill just to get the attention to have a conversation and maybe get something moving on some of these smaller details that we wish we wouldn't have to. There's a community process. We deal with these things. Southwest Corridor is coming through my district. Lots and lots and lots of community issues being raised. They filed their comments on the environmental impact statement. They're working through the Citizens Advisory Committee. There's been a lot of conversation to date. Continues, and there will continue to be some. I hope none of that results in anything like this.
Okay.
That's my sincere hope. Saw hands up in the air.
Mr. Chair, just a Ms. technical correction. The fiscal note before you does misstate that Met Council would be responsible as part of the Central Corridor Light Rail project for the operation and maintenance. Again, just to make sure that the committee is clear that that is not the case, that would be a city responsibility for that ongoing operation and maintenance expense.
So, Mr. Furman, is someone going to make a correction to that? It looks like you signed off on it yourself. So you with the EBO. So
we'll do the technical correction.
All right. Thank you, Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair, I've spoken to both Mr. Cardenas and Mr. Furman about Mr. Pratt or what Senator Pratt brought up and why this has come before us, and I think there are things that sometimes are not in the original scope of a project like this, and also there's not the understanding of just how much funds might be available. And I think both of those have come a lot clearer now. And I think Bill had, like Senator, things are a lot clearer right now than they were, and what I've spoken to Mr. Furman about is that if he would make a commitment now on the record that they will build this, We can table this bill, and Cardenas agrees. This would be a success if we. Now, Mr. Chair, if you would like to ask that to be put onto the record.
I'm sorry. Repeat that, Senator Carlson.
Mr. Furman would make a commitment in the record that proceed with building this access, that we would table the bill
Senator, my suggestion, Senator Carlson, is you just keep the bill moving. No harm in sending it to the floor. We don't need to act on it on the floor necessarily. It just continues to kind of keep the issue active. That's my advice. And, you know, our authority for the most part is over the Met Council. We understand that the council and the city are coming to an agreement, and the city ultimately, I think the plan is for the city to own and operate the elevator. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
However, if we keep the bill moving, the council would be responsible. And that's our measure of accountability to the council, to keep that conversation going so that they get an agreement signed on the dotted line. Mr. Cardenas.
So that means the bill is going forward?
Correct.
Okay.
Well, if it enjoys the support of the committee.
I trust the state.
All right. Anything further, members? Senator Carlson, you have a motion.
Mr. Chair, with that, I would move Senate File 590 be recommended to pass and proceed to the Senate floor.
Okay. Questions on the motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. Opposed, no?
No.
No.
Motion passes. Senator Champion. Senator Champion, Senate File 779.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee. Good afternoon, and I hope that I can get through this with some level of brevity so that you can go on with the rest of your day. This is a very simple bill. It's this Senate file really is about three parking lots located on the edge of downtown Minneapolis, known as the ABC ramps. And they were built when Highway 12 was upgraded to I-394. The ramps are a part of an interstate system. They are owned by MnDOT, but the city of Minneapolis operates the ramps through a private company. State law currently restricts the use of ramp revenues to parking facility improvements, parking incentives, and HOV improvements on I-394. This limits the options for investment opportunities. So just so you know, these ramps are over by the Target Center, not far from Target Field. And with the success of Target Field, there's, of course, you know, a number of people who come to park in these ramps. And currently, the revenues can only be used for specific usage. And once the operating costs and all the other costs that's mandated by the statute are done, then there's, thankfully, more revenue than what was originally determined. And so this bill seeks to say, what can we do in the city of, through MnDOT, in order to utilize these revenues in a way that's consistent with their intended purpose? And so when we think about this legislation, it allows more usage of the ABC parking ramp revenues in support of multimodal transportation options. And this proposal will generate additional opportunities for innovative solutions that support economic development and greater transportation options. And the city of Minneapolis, just so that you're clear, supports this proposal as well. And so MnDOT's objective is to manage the ABC ramps in a way that maintains the intended multimodal and environmental benefits while generating additional opportunities for innovative solutions that support economic development and transportation options for the public. So I have here a wonderful person from MnDOT who will talk a little more about the specific ideas and why this agency bill is before this committee. Chair Purdue.
Mr. Rudin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Champion did a very good job of explaining the bill. I think the only thing that I would add is that because these are officially part of the interstate highway system, the Federal Highway Administration also has a role. And we did confirm again today with Federal Highway Administration that they're supportive of these changes and are open to the expansion of using these revenues in potentially other ways. We have a working group that consists of interested parties, including the city and MnDOT officials, that meets to discuss the ramps and operational aspects of the ramps. And so that group would also be involved in discussing potential uses of these revenues.
Thank you. Questions, members? Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Champion, I actually use Ramp A when I park to go to Target. Whenever I do drive, I usually take the bus. But
thank you for your contribution.
I do contribute quite a bit. So my question is, what's the revenue we're talking about? What's the excess revenue? I was trying to see if there's numbers in some of the materials that we have, but I can't locate that. What's the excess amount that we're talking about here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, I'm going to have another person come up to answer that specific question.
Mr. Shadower.
Mr. Chair, Senator. My name is Mike Shadower. I'm the director of the Office of Transit, and we have the role of managing the ramps on behalf of MnDOT. And the ramps take in revenue is about $13.5 million per year, but it's not all revenue that can be spent on new projects. We end up having, and it ranges a lot according to the how well the twins do, among other things. But we'll have as extra revenue somewhere in the $1 to $2 million per year after all the maintenance work is done. And these are about 20 years old now, so there's a lot of upkeep to replace older parts of the ramps like elevators. So that $1 to $2 to $3 million a year of extra revenue.
Senator Franzen.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and just to make sure that those ramps are up, you know, kept up to par. You just mentioned they're about 20 years old. Where would any monies to fix or revamp or remodel, if there needs to be any of those expenses incurred, would that be? How would that be tackled if the monies are now, the excess is going to go somewhere else?
Mr. Shadow.
Mr. Chair, Senator Franzen, we manage the ramps so that we maintain a maintenance account that we don't spend on extra projects. So we are required in our agreement with the Federal Highway Administration, for example, to have about a $7 million fund always available just in case something horrible happens. So the money that we're talking about here is above and beyond what we keep for problems.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Right. So Senator Champion, Golf Academy on the top. I'm just kidding. Although I understand that the idea is back with us. We're going to have a meeting on it tomorrow, I think. So. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is, who pays the fees? And I think this is similar to Senator Franzen. So who pays these fees? Where does this money come from? Is this part of the HOV lane, that these are drivers of cars who are using the HOV lane? These are the ones that are paying into this?
Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Champion.
Senator Kiffmeyer, the users pay the fees. So those who use the ramps, not necessarily the HOV lanes, but the ramps is my understanding.
So these are parking charges.
Yes.
Folks pay for parking in the ramp. All right. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, just one other question. In regards to the end, there's a great big thing on the end of it that says not only is this construction, not just maintenance, it's construction, but I can see if you construct something that you might have additional revenue to pay for the construction or pay that back or something like that. I have that concern. But then also and related multimodal and technology improvements as well. So what might that mean?
Mr. Rudin.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, we actually don't have specific things in mind at this point, but one of the things that has been discussed is, for example, if we were to add a MinPass lane on Interstate 94 between downtown St. Paul and downtown Minneapolis, there would be some cost of installing the technology and so forth to make that feasible, and so that would be one One idea, which is actually something we did when we installed the MinPass lanes on 394, but because the language allowed it, we were able to do that under the current law, because those were improvements to the 394 corridor itself. So it would be something similar to that, but potentially on other freeways that serve downtown Minneapolis.
So it might help to just acquaint the committee very, very briefly, one or two or three sentences, about the ABC ramps and the relationship to 394 and the HOV, HOT lane, and Federal Highway Administration's funding of the ABC ramps, and you know, the fact that they're designed to all function together. I mean, 394 kind of get, you can drive right up into the ramps off of 394, so they were kind of designed to work hand in glove with 394. Can someone help us understand that history a little bit?
Sure. Mr. Chair, as you alluded to, and as Senator Champion mentioned, these ramps were built when the old Highway 12 was upgraded to an interstate in the late 80s. And the idea was that you would have these large ramps on the edge of downtown so that people who are commuting in on 394 would not be required to drive into downtown Minneapolis, but instead would park on the edge of downtown Minneapolis and then would use skyways or transit to reach their final destination within downtown. So the goal was certainly with the HOV lanes to encourage commuters and carpoolers. And in fact, the ramps to this day do offer discounted parking for people who are carpooling in the 394 corridor. And I think it was somewhat of an innovative approach back in that day. And certainly with the opening of Target Field, we have had more revenues than we've had in the past. And so now we have this luxury of exploring other alternatives for using these revenues.
And Mr. Dean, it also accommodates buses. There's a little kind of bus corralling, pickup rotation area. Is that true?
Yes, right. Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure if folks actually maybe haven't been in the ramps, but there is a significant bus facility in the ramp. It's a layover facility for Metro Transit, so there are waiting facilities for passengers, but also facilities for bus drivers to lay over there and take their breaks and so forth and use restrooms. And the ramps also now have bicycle facilities, so you can commute to the ramp and lock your bicycle. There are actually showers that are available for use for people who are bicycling to work. So they serve all modes of transportation.
Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Senator Champion. The more I listen to this, the more concerned I actually get, and the more controversial I think this is. When you pay a fee, you're paying a fee for the service. And my understanding of the fee for parking in the ABC ramps is to pay for the maintenance, appropriate maintenance and upkeep of the facility itself. So what you're saying here with this legislation is that we can maybe I'm wrong here, but you're going to exceed the scope of just the ramps, or is that's the is the money still going to be maintained within the ramps themselves? Because I'm very, very concerned that we're going to be straying outside of the scope by which the fees are being applied or being received.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Champion.
Senator, the proceeds here, if you look at line 1.11, and the latter part of it that says improvements that serve users of the parking facilities. So everything that's going to be done is going to enhance the experience and really look to contribute to improving the quality of not only the ramps but also the service that those individuals receive. So there is a direct correlation to the ramps and the fee that's paid. And so even though Mr. Rudin talked about some other expansions of usage, it's just not narrow to what has been historically done as just to operate, repair, and maintain the parking facilities. But it's also managed lanes and related multimodal and technology improvements that serve the parking facilities. So it's still with the mindset of serving the users of the parking facilities.
Mr. Chair, just one follow-up to that. So this would not, when it says managed lanes, it is the managed lanes directly on site of the parking facilities. We're not expanding beyond the footprint of the actual parking facilities themselves.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Champion.
Senator, that's my understanding. As I believe that Mr. Rudin was trying to communicate, is that back when the design was done some time ago, 20 years ago, the parking facilities goes right onto or others can come right to that parking facility. So it is directly from the highway to the parking facilities, therefore making it unnecessary for a person to go into the bowels of downtown without intending to truly go to this facility. So it's everything that is centered around the parking facilities, and that's what I want to make sure that we really lift up and make sure it's clear.
Senator Osmick, it's the folks parking at the facility who are generating the resources, to be sure. Mm-hmm. And I understand your suggestion that, well, okay, we can just lower the parking rates, and that's an alternative. But then you run into the problem of then kind of undercutting, you know, the public sector kind of undercutting, if you will, some of the other parking facilities that are managed privately around downtown Minneapolis, so that, you know, we would want to kind of balance what the market rate and kind of what the market is for parking in and around downtown Minneapolis, given the product. So I understand your point. It's a good point. But there's that balance to be struck. Mr. Rudin, like you're going to say something.
Mr. Chair, I was actually just going to make that same point. Part of the agreement for operating these ramps is that they are charging market rates for parking, and exactly as Senator Dibble indicated, we do not want to be in the position where we are offering highly discounted parking, because that could put us at a competitive advantage in the private sector, which is not what the intent of the ramps is either.
In my view, these ramps were built way too big. They're gargantuan. And they were underutilized for years. And as a matter of fact, there was a big management committee that came together and said, what are we going to do to drive utilization? Because carpooling just wasn't filling them up and other, you know, they're just too big. But then the Twin Stadium was built. That problem went away. And they're used quite a bit now, particularly on game day. So, so they're generating some money. Senator Pratt, and then Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Champion, Mr. Rudin. So with the proposed legislation, by taking out 394 to manage lanes, would the expectation be that the funds here are still used to manage the HOV lanes, which drive in the bus traffic, the wear and tear on those facilities, and help the state manage that entryway into the city, and particularly into those ramps?
Mr. Chair and Senator Price, certainly that would continue to be an eligible expense, and that would this does not in any way preclude us from continuing to make those sorts of investments. It just opens the possibility for, if there are excess revenues, to use them in other ways as well.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess that's maybe the concern that I have, is on prioritization, that these were dedicated to maintaining those lanes in good condition, and now if there was a way to address this with excess funds, might make some sense, that truly the people who are paying the fee, the user fee, are getting some benefit from it. And if I might, Mr. Chair, just one more question.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you. I'm hung up on the word multimodal and what your intention is with multimodal. Are we talking about constructing bike lanes into the facility? Are we talking about, or is it truly about vehicular traffic, as you said, on 94 and other, you know, entrance and exit services for the ramp?
Mr. Rudin.
Mr. Chair, I think it would include potentially bicycle facilities, pedestrian facilities, transit facilities. I don't think it would necessarily be limited to automobile vehicular traffic. Certainly that's, you know, that's a primary user of the ramps, and so that would continue, I would say, to be one of the priorities, but it would not necessarily be limited to that aspect.
All right. Senator Franz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would attest as a user of that facility, of the A-ramp in particular, it's a very well-run facility, and I have no complaints, so anything you can do to continue to enhance the experience, I think, would go a long ways, but I've had nothing but positive experience using those ramps, but as the proximity to North Star Commuter Rail, I mean, I think you're asking for flexibility to continue to enhance the experience in those ramps, and as a user myself, I think that would be appropriate and very positive.
Okay. Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was basically going to echo what Senator Franzen said. I'm also a user, even though I live in the East Metro. I make my way over there. And I can see, as the purposes of this facility evolve, some of these needs evolve. And, you know, one of the main reasons I've been over there is for Twins games, and sometimes you feel like the pedestrian crossings might be a little more pedestrian-friendly, especially when you have that many people there, small kids, that kind of thing. So I just think that as things change, that we need to be able to adapt and evolve with that. So thank you.
One last thing. Senator Franz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last thing, I forgot to mention the price. If you get there by 9 o'clock, you pay $7 a day, which is a bargain. Downtown is one of the cheapest places to park downtown if you get there by 9 o'clock. So that's why I park there when I do drive. So it's very competitive, actually probably one of the lowest places you can park prices in the downtown Minneapolis.
But we're not undercutting the market. Well, you pay a little less because you're a few blocks away from the court. So you have to hook it or catch a bus or something. It's not right in the court.
Mr. Chair, yes, you actually have to walk longer. So there's an incentive to park closer. You pay for what you get, so you have to walk a little longer if you park in the ABC ramp.
All right. Thank you. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, not to feel left out, I also have been a customer of your ramps in the past. Again, my concern happens to be on the prioritization. I don't have a tremendous concern with opening up the uses of funding. However, it's being generated by cars. It should be used to improve mass transit and vehicular traffic first and foremost. It was set aside for managing the HOV lane on 394, and that should still be, in my view, the primary use, as well as other potential lanes. I'd like to try to, if the author is open to it, I'd like to unstrike 390 on 394 in order to keep that as a primary focus of this funding.
Senator Champion, the suggested oral amendment striking the words on 394 on line 10, 1.10.
Mr. Strike.
What, remove the deleting, strike. What, restoring the language. That's restoring on 394.
May I speak to that?
Senator Champion.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I would oppose that motion at this particular time, as I believe it's important to leave the language just the way it is. MnDOT understands the priorities and will continue those priorities, but they need the flexibility, and so we just think it's important that that they not be limited in any shape, form, or fashion, but they understand the importance of this work and they understand the importance of this fee.
Thank you. Questions, members?
Mr. Chair, one question. Are there any managed lanes outside of 394 as it exists right now that this would then no longer apply to if this language was added?
Mr. Mr. Rudin.
Mr. Chair and Senator Osmak, no, as of today, there are not managed lanes. Well, 35W has a managed lane, but so I suppose theoretically it could be used on 35W south of downtown Minneapolis, but that was really not what the intent of this change was. The intent, as I mentioned earlier, was if there are future managed lane projects on other corridors that serve these ramps, that one potential source of funding for those types of projects would be this this money.
Mr. Chair, now my fear comes back again, because now we just heard 35W's managed lane being brought back into the equation. So I would suggest that having Senator Pratt's amendment does make sense, because if this is supposed to stay within the ramps and the ramps themselves and the complex itself, then 35W should not be part of the equation.
But Senator Osmak does say that serve users of the parking facilities. So 35W comes in from another part of downtown.
Point taken, but he brought it back into the equation again.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Champion.
Senator, the only reason why the testifier brought up 35 is because you asked if there are any other managed lanes, and so he answered your question thoroughly. But here, but he was also very careful and pointing it when he says that 35W South does not have any connection to this parking facilities. Therefore, it is not under consideration by any stretch of the imagination when you think in terms of what these revenues could be used for.
All right, Senator Pratt, did you make the motion?
Yes, I'd like to make a motion, and I believe Ms. Borofsky has the language I'd like to put in the record.
Ms. Berezovsky.
Mr. Chair and Senator Pratt, on 1.10, restore the stricken on I-394. On 1.11, after the period, insert any excess fee revenues in the account not needed for these purposes may be applied to operate, repair, and maintain other managed lanes.
Mr. Chair, I believe that preserves the original intent of the legislation of the account, and then opens it up to the flexibility that Senator Champion and MnDOT was looking for.
Senator Pratt, it sounds like the effect of the bill would remain in exactly the same, though. So I don't understand the purpose of the amendment, but you can.
The purpose of the amendment is to maintain the priority of the I-394 corridor by clarifying that excess funds not needed for that maintenance then be available for other uses, versus making them all the same priority to be managed by MnDOT.
Senator Champion.
Mr. Chair and committee, I would ask that you oppose this Senator Pratt's amendment with all due respect, as I believe that the priority is already clear, and the nexus between 394 and these parking ramps is already in the design and in the thinking of this legislation.
All right. Anything further, members?
Just a clarification.
Senator Tom
Stoney. Mr. Chairman, what's the difference between high occupancy and managed?
Mr. Rudy.
Mr. Chair and Senator Tomasoni, a managed lane, for example, could include a dynamic shoulder, which does not have a requirement for a certain number of people. And high-occupancy vehicle lane requires two or more people to be used, but, for example, a dynamic shoulder may just be open to all traffic during peak periods and then close during non-peak periods and serve as a shoulder.
That's what we call the HOT lane. So if you're a solo driver and you want to get into the high occupancy vehicle lane, you can pay a little toll. And
Yeah, but managed means you don't, doesn't have anything to do with high occupancy, right?
You can still ride in the lane with two or more for free. So yes.
Managed.
In a managed lane. Yeah.
And HOV, no.
So HOV, pure HOV lane, you have to have two or more people,
right,
in your car. In an HOT or a managed lane, you can have one person in your car for a fee, for a little toll.
Fee.
Yeah, depending on, you know, peak hour, et cetera. So. to manage.
That was a better explanation than what he gave.
Okay, anything further? All in favor of the Pratt Amendment say
Mr.
aye.
Mr. Chair, may I request a roll call, please?
A roll call has been requested. Chair votes no.
Senator Carlson. Senator Champion.
No.
Senator Franzen.
No.
Senator Jensen.
No.
Senator Kent.
No.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yes.
Senator Miller.
Yes.
Senator Osmick.
Yes.
Senator Peterson. Senator Pratt.
Yes.
Senator Reinert.
No.
Senator Rest. Senator Senjum.
Yes.
Senator Tomasoni.
No.
Senator Westrom. Senator Wieger.
No.
On a 5-8 vote, the amendment or the motion does not prevail. Senator Champion?
Mr. Chair, I make a motion that Senate File 779 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register.
Anything further, members? Anyone else want to testify on this bill? I keep forgetting to ask that. All right. On the Champion motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. Opposed, no?
No.
Motion passes. All right. Thank you, Senator Champion. Senator Senjum, Senate File 692. Welcome, Senator Senjum.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Senate File 779 pertains to an initiative has actually been here before, 4 to 6 years ago. Senator Murphy was chair.
692, Senator.
I think that it got lost in conference committee along the way, and so some things never die, and so it's back, and we'll see how it goes.
What I love about legislators, they keep coming back to their ideas. Diligence.
What this is all about, in 2005, they completed a stretch of highway through Rochester, which some of you have been on, Highway 52, a wonderful six-lane highway with sound walls and all the proper geometrics relative to off-ramps and on-ramps and all of that, and that's been certainly a great project for the city. There's always some unintended consequences, and one of those is before us today. And has been before this committee before. It relates to the sound walls and the obstruction of sound walls to certain businesses. In this case, at a certain location, 37th Street and Highway 52, I wouldn't expect you to know where that is, but there has been a sound wall erected. It has, over the years, been a detriment to at least one business and probably others. And the request is that the owner of this business or any business at this location, frankly, there are others, would be allowed to have what we call a specific sign, such as you see very frequently along the highway, placed in anticipation of the off-ramp going to his business, so it would indicate where that business location is. Let me just stop there, Mr. Chair, and to introduce Mr. Paul Kiefer, who is the principal, I think, force behind this initiative, and let him speak to his more personal problem.
Thank you, Senator Senjum. Mr. Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members, to hear me out. Excuse me, I got a little head cold. In 2002, we built a Red Wing shoe store. There was a premier location, and it's still not the worst location in the town, but it went down 20% in business as soon as the sound wall went up. And all I'm asking for is one of those little blue signs that says Red Wing Shoe Store with an arrow that I would be happy to pay for. It's kind of a minor deal. And I think that could bring back that 20%. Of course, you know, I can't exactly judge it's 20% at this point because it's been numerous years since that happened, but it definitely hurts business. Another negative is when people see my store, they either try to exit off too fast, which is a danger problem, or they have to go 2 miles down the highway to the 55th Street exit, which is a couple miles down, a couple miles back, a lot of horsing around. I'm not asking for a big deal here. I'm just asking to put a little blue sign up that says Red Wing Shoe Store with an arrow. That's all there is to it. The negative is, I guess, the DOT people want it to only be restaurants or gas stations or hotels. So we're a little bit squeaking one in here, but I think it's a good enough deal for Minnesota. First of all, we're selling a Minnesota-made product. So it's a win-win-win. I don't see any loss in it to anybody. So that's what I'm asking for.
Thank you, Mr. Keeper. I have Senator Reinert and then Senator Westrom.
Thank you, Chair Dibble. Are we at Q&A time? I've got a couple.
Yes.
Okay. I'm sorry, sir. What was your name?
Paul Kiefer.
Paul. And maybe we should have somebody from MnDOT give their 2 cents worth.
Yeah, Senator Reinert, someone from MnDOT is on the witness list. So.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Paul, your understanding, is there one of those, you know, preceding the sex, and I apologize, I'm in Duluth. I haven't been to Rochester for a while. But, you know, prior to most major exits, you've got the sign that says gas, food, lodging this way. Is there one of those? So it would,
no.
Okay. Because as I look at the other pictures taken, it looks like there are probably some other businesses that might love to have, you know, if you were successful, Papa John's would probably be like, hey, that'd be great. We'd love to.
The Mr. restaurants.
Kiefer.
Can I speak? The restaurants can have signs if they elect to.
Right.
But as a shoe store, we cannot. That's why I'm here.
All right. Mr. Chair, I just had to note, given these fancy handouts, do we still have that huge request for City of Rochester coming at this session? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, I'm fine to wait till after MnDOT talks.
Okay.
I'd like to know why some do it and some don't, or some businesses are.
All right, very good. So we have Peter Buchan from MnDOT. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, before I get started, I do have two handouts that I'd like to share.
Someone will come take those from you and hand them out. She wants me to. Why don't you go ahead? While they come around.
I'm Peter Buchan, the Assistant State Traffic Engineer for MnDOT's Office of Traffic Safety and Technology. I'm here today, and as the handout goes around, I'll be referring to them to provide you a little bit of information on our signing programs and why they're implemented, and I'll be referring to those throughout. We do oppose this bill for two reasons. The primary purpose of a traffic sign is to provide regulatory warning and guidance information to tourists. Traffic signing is not intended to be an advertising device. MnDOT signing policies are based on Minnesota statute and federal guidelines. As I described earlier, the Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Devices is a federal document, of which we have a similar state document that is in substantial compliance with the federal document and has been accepted by the FHWA. This bill would put in place a retail business specific service sign on a freeway. This type of sign is ineligible for freeway use, as is this type of business. The document that you have in front of me, the Supplemental Guide Sign Program, describes the purpose of guide signs. And the purpose of guide signs is to help guide motorists to services that they need during their trip. This is the majority of motorists would need this. These typically include gas, food, lodging. All of these are accessible from 37th Street, as was noted earlier. If you look at the back of this handout, there are the different types of programs that fall, that qualify under the specific, under this signing. The logo signs, which are in the upper left-hand corner, are the signs that are used on freeways. You're probably familiar with those and have seen them elsewhere. We have nearly 2,000 businesses represented on those signs in the freeways across the state. They, again, are typically gas, food, lodging, and camping, as we've just added attractions to that, and 24-hour pharmacies are there. Specific service signs are shown in the lower right-hand corner. Those are a small independent plaque which you'll typically see on a two-lane roadway or an expressway. Those are the signs that are allowed for non-freeways. They expand that use a little bit to include places of worship and agricultural businesses and tourist-oriented business. There is a tremendous amount of demand for signing along our highways. MnDOT manages and maintains nearly 400,000 signs. Many businesses, organizations, and agencies request signs. When they are denied a sign based on the policies and laws which we have described to them, and they still believe that they should get a sign, they have the option to appeal this to the External Sign Variance Committee. I've handed it, the second handout that you have shows the makeup of that committee. This committee, MnDOT is not a voting member on this committee. We organize it, we do the clerical work, we set the schedules, and we gather them together. We do provide our testimony as well as technical information if requested. But you can see this committee is represented as volunteer committee representing members of the Chamber of Commerce, tourism, private business, and city and county governments. The process for this is when a sign requester believes that they should have a sign and that the rules do not apply to them, they can then go to the committee, and the committee will hear their requests as well as they will hear MnDOT's request, or MnDOT's position on this. They familiarize themselves with the bills. They get this information in advance. They listen to the testimony, and then they make a recommendation on whether or not this sign should receive a variance to the Commissioner of Transportation. Over the 28 years of the existence of this committee, they've heard 201 requests, and they have approved 61 appeals. A retail shoe store located at this intersection has gone through this process and been to the External Sign Variance Committee and been denied. After reviewing the policies and the requests, they determined that this was an ineligible business to be put on this sign. MnDOT opposes this bill because it identifies a signing type that's not allowed on freeways. It also adds retail business. Signs are to inform motorists of services that they need along their trips and are usually geared towards motorists that are unfamiliar with the area. A business such as this generally is known by its residents, and they know it. They do not need a sign to find their way there. If allowed, we anticipate that we would see a tremendous increase in requests for retail businesses, and we are not sure how we would be able to handle such a thing because they're so diverse. It could include clothing stores, it could include pet shops, it could include craft shops, the list goes on, and it would be very difficult to manage retail businesses. Again, these are not something that a motorist, a traveler, as they're trying to reach their destination, generally find a need for. The long-standing external variance process works very well at addressing these signing concerns. We suggest that that continues and that this not be put into law.
Thank you, Mr. Buchan. Mr. Buchan, did I hear you correctly that this particular sign has been in front of this variance committee?
Yes, it has. Right,
thank you. Questions, members? Senator Franzen.
I think Senator Westrom had.
Oh, Senator Westrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions. Do you charge for any of these signs, the ones that are on the approved list?
Kavukin.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrum.
Or who pays for
them? Yes, we do charge for that. These signs are approximately $1,000 per sign.
And Senator Westrum. Mr. Chair, MnDOT pays for them, or the party or the entity being advertised pays the cost, or is the $1,000 the fee and it doesn't cost us that much so we generate revenue? Or just give me a little sketch of that quick.
Mr. Bukin, Mr. Chair. Is this our profit center? Is this how we actually pay for our roads?
No, it's not. That's a one-time fee unless the sign is damaged or knocked down. It is paid for by the sign requester. It would be out there for 12 to 15 years if there's no damage done to the sign. It's a one-time cost. If the sign is knocked down or the business goes out of place or out of business, the sign can be removed. When the sign's knocked down, the business is contacted to see if they want to continue to have the sign, and they have to pay the cost of replacing the sign and putting it in place.
And Mr. Bukin, to Senator Westrum's other part of his question, $1,000 meets our costs. It's what it costs us.
The $1,000 covers the cost of fabrication of the sign. When we install a sign, we need to send out a locator, the Gopher One, to be sure that there's no utilities in the area. And it also then covers the cost of the crew and the truck to get out there and the materials to place the sign. And that's all. It recovers those costs. There's no profit in that.
Right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, you talked about some additions that were recently made. Did the volunteer committee make those decisions, or who decided to add places of worship? Forget a few of the other things you listed, but tell us why they were added and who made those decisions.
There were attractions.
Attractions, yeah. I guess, yeah, that was another
Mr.
one.
Mr. Bukin.
Mr. Chair and Senator, just for clarification, because I've talked about two different signing programs, the logo signing program, which is the freeway signing program, had attractions added. And in the previous bill that was discussed, the reason for that, the attractions being added, is that is currently in federal language, and this brings the state into compliance with federal language for attractions. And again, those are something that would be seen by visitors into the area and not geared towards residents.
Senator Westrum.
Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to get an understanding, and I can appreciate Katie bar the door because everybody wants signage, so hence my first question. I mean, if they do, what's wrong with selling more blue squares? If you sell multiple together, 1,000 times X should give you some quantities of efficiency and maybe be more than what it costs us, but that's kind of another topic for a different day, I guess. Where do we draw the line here? It seems like we find reasons to allow. I know campgrounds or camping was not so long ago added. At least there was an issue up in central or northern Minnesota that they wanted to have Maplewood State Park listed on some of the main highways, freeway and highway 10, so people were aware of it. Here it seems like we've got a special situation. I assume, was it MnDOT that put this retaining or sound wall up, sir? Did I understand that right?
Senator.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrum, yes, and there's no quarrel with, you know, the sound wall. It just, there are circumstances that arise,
right,
and this is one of them.
But it does, Mr. Chair, and to the MnDOT witness, I mean, it does seem like it brings forth a different situation than just your normal, we don't want more signs up there. When there are barriers, sound barriers, I'm wondering if there shouldn't be a reasonable exception made for retail businesses. After all, but for them, we wouldn't need people to be buying gas to use the road in the first place. And so I think there should be a happy medium. But I'm wondering why do we not have any other exceptions, or if they have a sound barrier and they lose the visibility from the traveling public, is that just not a reasonable way to deal with some of these exceptions?
Mr. Bukin.
Mr. Chair and Senator, you bring up a good point. I'm not aware of any, to address one issue, I'm not aware of any exceptions to this. There are sound walls, as you've experienced when you drive through the metro. They are everywhere. Sound walls are put in during a project at the request of the community and the residents as they attend the public hearing. So the sound walls are determined, are put in at that request rather than something that MnDOT mandates should be in place, because they, too, come with them a cost to maintain over the long term.
Right.
There are, and also, as you may experience in the metro area, there are private businesses that are behind those sound walls, and whether and which was there first is not really known to me, but I'm not aware of any exceptions to this. We do have a multitude of signing programs to try and meet the needs, and this is not a compensation sort of a thing because of the noise wall, which is what I think that you're getting at.
Well, Mr. Chair, and final comment. I mean, I think I'm getting at both parts. One, I'm thinking, people pay good money for location. That's oftentimes why you buy real estate. If all of a sudden you have your location and visibility taken, either MnDOT should pay a some sort of a price of an easement to take away somebody's line of view. And I'm just talking, out loud here, but.
I hear an amendment.
Given this situation, it seems reasonable that we would find a way to let these people sign and give the traveling public. I mean, somebody from Rochester might know where Red Wing is, but somebody from Alexandria may not, and goes to Rochester for medical and other reasons, and maybe to buy Red Wing shoes. And so I'm just thinking that couldn't there be a way to especially in these situations. I think Senator Senjum's bill brings forth a good issue, and I would lean to supporting it. And I guess I would think MnDOT could maybe come up with some recommendations of how we could do this. But, Mr. Chair, I'm thinking if businesses find the value in advertising, maybe there's even a practical way to do some more advertising. And the blue signs, I know, are a nice, helpful tool. And, it's as a rural legislator, the metro areas that are most visible, and the McDonald's or the Burger King's or the Sonic's or you name it, they get our business. If they're visible, they get our business. You don't spend time driving around the backsides of sound barriers to figure out where you're going to shop or what you're going to feed your kids. And so I think the bill is a good idea we should discuss.
Speech in favor. Senator Franzen, then Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Is it Kiefer?
Kiefer.
Mr. Kiefer, I work for a national retailer, and I actually worked on signage for a portion of my job, so I know how coveted signage is and how important it is to run a retail business, no matter what size you are. So my first question was kind of along Senator Westrom's. Was there a public process where you voiced your concern, or was this something that you realized was a problem after the wall was built?
Mr. Kiefer.
Chair, Senator.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Franzen, no, we didn't get to voice much opinion. I do know that one of my neighbors went up and down the whole area and asked if anybody wanted that sound wall, and nobody wanted that sound wall. I think when there's so much traffic, there's a rule, the Pollution Control Agency says you put up the sound wall. That's all there is to it. It's black and white. So you really don't get a chance to voice an opinion.
Sure.
Senator Franzen.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Kiefer, I do understand that, the importance of signage, and I also do have the concern that MnDOT presented in terms of opening up Pandora's box and everybody wants signage, and right. It just opens the floodgates and it'll be just confusing, maybe cause safety hazard. But I think in this situation, it sounds like there's a compelling reason that you were there first, essentially, and we had to put a wall because that's what we do, but it had a negative effect on your business. And there's probably a reason why there's a Chamber of Commerce person on this External Signage and Variance Committee, which, by the way, is currently vacant. So you might not have a voice there right now. I do feel like there might be, to Senator Westrom's suggestion, room for maybe not make it a common practice, but in this case, it's a safety issue regardless if where the signage would be. I don't agree it should be a MnDOT signage, but pylon signage, something that you can actually get an easement for, so your business is not negatively impacted like you mentioned it was, 20% reduction in sales, which is substantial for any small business. So I do sympathize with that. I just don't know if this is a proper forum to address that or if MnDOT has another venue where you do work not on a signage variance but in an easement or something where you can actually put up a pylon sign. You pay for that. That's what, you know, you private businesses do. Because in this particular case, there was a negative impact on business, and there needs to be, you know, where do you draw the line? But at the same time, you don't want to hurt the businesses that are created in businesses like you should not have the be put in a situation where you have to move because you can't sustain your business there. So I definitely find it a compelling argument to discuss what can be done.
Thank you, Senator Franzen. Calling Senator Kent. Mr. Book and I had a question. Mr. Kiefer makes an argument in his materials, I don't know if you've seen them, that folks who do notice the store after they get past the wall and they decide, ooh, I really need a pair of Red Wing shoes today, might make a very quick movement to get over there to get to the store. And I know your argument to not do the signs is clutter and traffic safety and the like, but is that considered in this situation? I mean, I think that might be, I don't know, maybe not, but it seems to me like a rational argument that there's a, you know, the fact that folks might be making quick movements a little too late in the game to get over to his store might present a safety hazard. Is that something that MnDOT considers in these instances or could consider?
Chair, no, that's not part of the consideration. The consideration for signing is that it be in advance and be visible. But as far as the location of the business, we don't take that into consideration other than the business needs to have its own signing. And if it is visible from the roadway, that it is not eligible for signs. There are a lot of businesses, as you're aware, that have this pile signing, as was referred to by the senator, and on site. And there are many of them at this interchange that have these tall mast signs that is they have the ability to advertise on their site with those signs if they choose to. And that's governed by a city ordinance, but I do know there's a number of those in the Rochester area.
Right. Senator Kent.
My question, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think is a little bit related, and it has to do with what is the distinction between other traffic generators and attractions and private businesses. I can think of, and I have to say, I think in some circumstances, a Red Wing Shoes can fall into that circumstance. L.L. Bean in Freeport, Maine, I mean, there are places that are destinations, and they become an attraction. And I don't know if Red Wing, outside of Red Wing, if Red Wing in Rochester qualifies. I'm not in a position to make that determination. I wonder if that was something that was discussed by the variance committee. But it's just, and I don't know that we can resolve it now, but it's just sort of a question of how those determinations get made. And because exactly as Senator Dibble was describing, if somebody is actually interested in, oh, man, that's a Red Wing Shoes. I never get to go to one of those. You know, it does. It's different than just passing a Walmart. You know, I just throw that out there.
Thank Senator you. Thomasoni looks hurt.
I know,
Mr. Chair. He screeches over for Walmart.
Mr. Chair, I missed the last part of that. Could Senator Kent repeat? No.
I'd put Duluth Pack on the list too.
Chair, Senator Sengen.
Can I just offer, you know, and I happened to observe last night, but in the area of what we call a specific services sign, and that I think is to point out an attraction sort of in the eyes of the beholder. And I know at the Zumbrota exit last night coming up,
there was one of these signs that I wasn't really frankly even looking at or forward, but happened to notice it was an antique shop. And to many, that's an attraction. There's no question about it. At the same point, I think maybe has been pointed out, and we see some of this in Rochester by virtue of the medical business, we see a lot of foreign people. And to those people, if you can buy blue jeans or Red Wing shoes, that may well be an attraction to you. So my point is that I think it's a hard to define, but what really is an attraction, and it will depend, I think, on circumstances.
Okay. I think we have explored. Oh, I guess not. Senator Ryan.
Mr. Chair, is your intent we're going to vote, or are you going to hold it over? What's your
Senator Reiner, we're going to take a vote.
All right, thank you.
Anything further, members? Anything further, Senator Senjum? Would anyone like to testify on this bill? Senator Senjum, do you have a motion?
Mr. Chair, hopefully a favorable vote here, I would move that Senate File 692 be recommended to pass and be referred to the floor. Thank you very much.
Great. On the Senjum motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. Thank you.
Much.
Members, let's see. I have announcements. Where do they go? There they are. Michael has announcements. So on Wednesday, we're meeting in room 107. We've been bumped because there's a big, huge hearing down here on Wednesday. I don't even know what it is. Fracking. Fracking has displaced us. And turns out you all did have a lot of good ideas, and you've introduced a ton of bills. So we may have one, possibly two evening hearings next week, depending on how long our regular committees take during the week next week, because we got to meet deadlines. So with anything further, members, with that, we are adjourned.